This week, we begin a series entitled Dark Clouds, Silver Linings, with the surprising virtue of loneliness. Is God a first thing pleasure in your life? How do you differentiate between needs and desires? What does it mean for a Christian to be homesick? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are doing a series I have wanted to do for about 3 years. Finally decided this is the time to do it. It's called Dark Clouds and Silver Linings. And I'd like to tackle what the Bible says about 7 or 8 things that are really, really hard in life. We're going to look at loneliness today. Next week, we're going to look at emptiness, discouragement, week 3, loss or depression, week 4, fear, worry, anxiety, week 5, week 6, anger and frustration, week 7, failure, and week 8, when you just have that awful, gripey, whiny, complaining spirit that you just can't seem to get rid of. All right, today we're talking about the surprising virtue of loneliness. Loneliness. Now, in our typical Western culture, Western Christian culture, there are 2 experiences that, in my opinion, are going to be part of our Christian experience as we grow. But you are not going to hear this from most of the TV guys out there preaching the gospel, especially some of the bigger ones, not Rick, but some of the ones around the country. There are 2 experiences I think of. One is what I think of as the Ecclesiastes experience, where Solomon, if you read Ecclesiastes, it reads like almost any book that's different. It almost reads like a diary. He was a man of wisdom, but the wisdom he had wasn't enough. And that set him off in search of what can I find that will satisfy my life? And he's sort of writing this diary in process, in real time, as it's going on. And you read that book, if you don't know that this is a diary, you're thinking, man, this is the strangest Bible book I've ever read. Now, it's my opinion that all of us who are Christians go through a similar experience as Solomon's. That's part of our sanctification process of growing up to be like Christ. There's an Ecclesiastes experience that we all go through that should not be a surprise to us. The second experience we're going to look at the tail end of this series is what I think of as the Job experience. And that is when some avalanche falls on you, some suffering that you thought could ever occur to you. Why would God let this happen? It's my opinion again, both from the scriptures and then just watching people's lives and looking at my own life, that there are times where we go through something of the Job experience. It may not be as hard as Job, but when those things happen, in one sense, it should not surprise us. Because our redeeming God takes these dark clouds and there's a silver lining in each one of them. He uses those things redemptively in our lives. Today we're going to look at loneliness, the surprising virtue of loneliness. There are 5 things I want to say about loneliness. All right, 5 things I want to say from our scriptures today about loneliness. Number 1. The principle of God as first thing pleasure. God as first thing pleasure. Now, what do I mean by first thing? This is a picture of you and me. We're made in the image of God, and we are made for relationship. We're made for relationship with Him and in relationship with others. And Matthew 22:37-38 says, "You love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." He says there, priority number 1, ahead of everything else you'll read in the Old Testament, is right here. Now, he says we are to love the Lord our God. I think he assumes that we are experiencing his love as well. And we are experiencing his love as a first thing need, a first thing priority, a first thing pleasure. Most important. First thing. Then he says, follows that up with, the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and prophets hang on these 2 commandments. The order is important. What is a first thing pleasure? What's a first thing need? Yesterday I coached soccer, had my game yesterday. Galen came, we had a great time. laughing and enjoying the game. A first thing pleasure for me was that during the game, I did not want at any single moment to be about me. I wanted self to be put out at about as far away from there as possible, and to be able to give these kids, these parents, the other coach, the other kids, the other parents, and the referee a delightful morning from 9 to 10. And what I was hoping was that when I went to the car, after it was all said and done, and got in my car, that I could say, you know, God, I think that old man Seth was away from the field today, and I think I brought you some pleasure today. That's the first thing, pleasure. If I had made it a second thing, pleasure, it would have been something like, oh, yeah, you know, God, by the way, I know I shouldn't make this about self, so please help me not do that. But in the old days, my real first pleasure would have been need to win. Need to look good as a coach. Need to be impressive to the other coach and some of the other parents. And when I get home, I want to look at myself in the mirror and think, hey, pretty sharp guy. You follow me on this? First thing needs, first thing pleasure, first thing priority. Jesus says, has to do with our relationship with God. Second thing priority, second thing pleasure, second thing desires, has to do with people. Now, I don't know about you. If you've been a Christian more than about a year, you've probably had this experience. I got this verse, love God with all my heart, soul, mind, strength. And you go off to do that, and you find I found a very troubling thing. And that is, I didn't do that very well at all. It seemed to me like I loved a whole bunch of other things, a whole lot more than the things over there on that side of the table. These seemed to be more important to me. In reality, these had become, were, first thing priorities, and my relationship with God was in reality a second thing priority. Now, why does God insist on me loving him? Well, I faced the fact that I was pretty bad at loving God with all my heart, all my soul, all my mind. My mind wanders after about 7 seconds. Now, what I discovered was this. If I'm supposed to love God with all my heart, all my soul, all my strength, all my mind, and I'm so terrible at it, what kind of love is it that still wants me to love him? Because if somebody loved me the way I love God, after a while I'd say, don't call me, I'll call you. I get up the next day and try to love God, and I last about 7 or 8 seconds. And there's a sense of just failure. I just don't love God very well at all. I'm terrible at this. How is it, God, that you love somebody like me? Over and over, day after day after day, again and again and again, after my repeated failures over and over and over again. Now, what I was learning, here's one of the silver linings, is that I was learning a very different kind of love than I'm going to find anywhere else on earth. It's a grace kind of love that doesn't really matter if I failed today, or if I'm going to fail tomorrow, or if I failed yesterday, or if I lasted maybe 10 seconds today before my mind went off to fight Civil War battles. Somebody still wants me. My failure, my messing up, my spiritual losses don't change the fabric of what's in here. And every morning, there's somebody who wants me, who wants to spend time with me, wants my friendship, wants my companionship. Yeah. That's what we think of. We call grace, but grace may be the thing we usually think of about, like, praying over dinner. But grace is unmerited favor. It's just love bestowed no matter who you are, what you are, what you did yesterday, or what you're going to do today or tomorrow. This is what our hearts are designed to experience. And you will find that nowhere else. That kind of love, nowhere else, even in the best of people. Second thing. Your heart was designed for grace, love, nothing else will do. Now, if this is not a first thing priority, a first thing need, then we set ourselves up for an astounding amount of loneliness at point one. First item is loving God and experiencing His love, a first thing need in my life. Now, another thing we do is, second thing we do is we torpedo this by doing this. What in my heart of hearts as a sinner I do is I say my first, my real needs have to do with these little cups right here. Why, if I can just be funny at my fraternity party, I feel pretty good. If I can just date a sharp girl at the fraternity party, I feel pretty good. If I can go coach a game and all the parents think I hung the moon, feel pretty good. Because that's what I really need. If my wife gives me the attention I want her to give, if my husband listens to me like I want him to give, this is what I need. If my kids are thankful for all the sacrifices that I make, this is what I need. Am I asking for all that much? That's our natural state. That's what we do. And we say, well, you know, God sort of works in the realm of my desires. At Christmas, if I need a place to park, I pray to Him at the mall, and He provides a place for me. I pray over my meal. But that's where life is. That's how we are. Now, when we do this, we set ourselves up for not just this amount of loneliness, but now loneliness plus aggravation. Loneliness number two. All right, let's go to point number two. Second thing that these verses say to me is God's trying to move us from love received to love given. He said you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, if you are dealing with loneliness, it's very likely that you have said, you have told your spouse, you have told your mother-in-law or somebody, I know you want me to love, but I just don't have anything to give. And you read verses like this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. You're thinking, me? Don't you understand my tank is so empty? What do I have to give? I might have just a little smidgen of something in here to give to somebody else. But man, it seems like it would sure help if somebody would pour something in this jar. Then tell me to go love. And I'm on it. But he doesn't do that. He said, well, the most important thing is to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. But I know that you're pretty lonely and pretty weak. And so why don't you take about a year off and just go take care of yourself and love yourself? Now, that is not a cure for loneliness. This is the paradox of the love tank. The paradox of the love tank and God's work in me is that it seems to me like if only God would pour some love into me over here and I would feel love, then I would have something to give. When that happens, it's very easy for, if we're thinking that this is the realm of need, this is the first thing, that I'm going to be emptier or lonelier after that process. What God says to do is, you are going to experience a different kind of love as you give it, not as you receive it. You are not to be a consumer first. It's okay to be a consumer second. Nothing wrong with that. But what love has to be is you are a producer first, a consumer second. It's not enough to sit by and over here and say, I'm just so lonely and nobody will call me. Nobody will ask me out for coffee. Nobody will have lunch with me. I'm just so lonely. I'm just so fed up. Now, we've all had those thoughts. I've had those thoughts. That's not the answer to my lonely problem, not from God's point of view. What God is trying to do is build something into me where I am driven to Him as a first priority need, and then out of that, as I experience something from Him, I am now caught up with God, relationship with Him, grace-filled love. I experience something out of Him. What He doesn't say is, now you can sit back and just enjoy this. Oh, isn't this just so, me and Jesus is so lovely. The very next thing He says is, love your neighbor as yourself. Meaning, take some of this that you've experienced here and find a way to give it away. This is a tremendous paradox to human nature, because we just don't think that way. We just don't think that way. Now, when you start to try to love like this, to love people like this, you're going to make a second kind of awful discovery. And that is, very few people love you the way you're trying to love them. And at the beginning, that creates more loneliness. Now, the silver lining is, it's going to drive you back to God. God, there really is nobody out there that loves me like you do. And you're going to sink your roots a little bit deeper into that love, a little bit more into the cross and His delight in you as a person. A third thing I want to say about needs and desires. I'm going to illustrate this from Jesus and then from one of the commandments. Jesus said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers, sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. These are staggering words. Now, what does he mean by hate? Hate my father and mother? Aren't we commanded to honor father and mother? Yes, we are. Aren't I commanded to love my father and mother? Yes, I am. So he's using the word hate differently than what we would just read if we're reading this on the surface. Hate his wife and children? I'm to love my wife. I'm to love my kids. He's using hate in a different way. His brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life. Now, what's he saying? All these people are people over here on this side of the stage. My wife, my children, my brothers and sisters, my friends, people in our church, people I work with, all folks over there. What does he mean by I'm to hate those people? Doesn't mean I'm supposed to hate them. But what he's describing is, that the difference, the distance between what I'm experiencing over here and what I'm experiencing here, the difference between what I'm expecting here and what I'm expecting over here is about as different as love and hate, night and day, sun and moon. What he's trying to describe is the internal workings of our heart, what we call expectations. What in my heart do I really, really, really expect is going to fill me? And what Jesus is saying in this verse is, if you think it's going to be all these folks over here, you're in for a long ride. And so are they. That is a bad idea. Now, there's nothing wrong with desiring these folks to love me like I wish they would. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing unspiritual about that. It's a good thing. It's a good desire. We were made for connection. But if I swap the need for desire chart here and say, I need this from my wife, I need something from my kids, I need something from the people I work with, I need something from my boss, I need something from my relatives, ooh boy. We are setting ourselves up for a massive amount of conflict and aggravation. Second thing, desires are appropriate. But if I take second thing desires and make them first place needs, I set myself up for a train wreck. This has nothing to do with my wife, nothing to do with my kids, nothing to do with the people I work with. It has everything to do with what's going on in my heart. Now, the commandments sort of illustrate the same thing with different language. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, typically when you read this, we think about the little statues and statuettes and, you know, Baal and Asherah pole and all that stuff, Canaanite gods. But he's not talking about particular things. He's talking about, when he uses idol, he means anything or anyone or any event that you try to take from this side of the table as a desire and make it a need. That defines idol. When I expect someone or something or some event to do for me what only God can do for me, I am an idolater. I can do that with humor. I can do that with wisdom. I can do that with my social ability. I can do that. People do that with their dress or their car or their career, or what people think of them, or wanting everybody to like me. All of those things are idols. Whenever I take one of these things on this side and put it on this table, I set myself up for idolatry. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, meaning attach highest worth, need to them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. In other words, what he's saying is, this is serious stuff. This is not just a nice Sunday school lesson to take home. Oh, Pastor Seth had such a good message today. That was just awesome. And to forget about it. The reason God is a jealous God is not junior high jealousy, boyfriend, girlfriend. It's because he knows that when we try to take something from this side of the table and put it over here, we are going to screw ourselves royally. And it's going to have a big effect on your relationship with him. But showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, this is sort of how it works invisibly in our heart. We foolishly take second thing desires and make them first thing desires without even knowing we're doing it. And then we turn them into first thing needs. And then these morph into demands. We sort of get in our mind that this is how it ought to be, and this person ought to treat me a certain way, and I deserve this, and what did I do to deserve something different from this? We become justified and hardened that the world needs to treat me the way I deserve to be treated. And we're going to make a colossal mess of things. Now, let's take a little case study from Solomon. The book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon had all kinds of, he was a very wealthy man. He had all the means with which to do anything he wanted to find fulfillment instead of emptiness. But what I want to look at today is loneliness. In 1 Kings 11:3, the writer of Kings, the historian, says he had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Now, concubine is a word we don't use very often. Concubine is a word that means a wife who doesn't get to inherit royal property. So, he had 1,000 wives. 1,000 wives. 1,000. I've got one. Got my hands full. I like it. But I got my hands full. I'm not complaining. You won't hear me complaining about my girl. Now, when I was younger, a lot younger, I remember thinking, wow, that's a harem. Wow, that's 1,000 women. Wow, that's kind of like every 18-year-old dream, right? Oh, man. I wonder if Solomon thought that. He probably did. Because think about this. At one time, he had one wife. Now, what would make him think, I think I need number two? What would be going on in the human heart that would say, after a while, that makes sense to me? She's a different kind of woman. She looked different. She acted different. And he marries number two, and for a while he's really happy. And then he sees somebody else. And number three gets his attention. Now, you think, man, this guy was kind of a slow learner, because he repeated that process another 997 times. I may look stupid, but I don't have to be stupid. All right. Now, he writes in his diary, Ecclesiastes 2:8, I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, man's delight. That was the hook. That was the pleasure. That pleasure, at that time in his life, became a first thing need, as he saw it. And he was going to drive that thing into the ground until it worked. Because it should. It ought to. It could. What could keep this from not working? Now, you might think, well, when did he finally wake up and smell the coffee? Well, five chapters later in Ecclesiastes, the diary progresses probably a number of years. And this is what he says in verse 26. I found more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets. Snares. Think about a bear trap out in the woods. Think about when you see this on the news when a dolphin or a whale gets caught in those nylon fishing nets and they have a hard time moving. He's describing something of his reality in trying to work this thing out. It wasn't playing out like he once imagined it was going to. Whose hands are fetters. Think about somebody being led off to death row or chains. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Now, what is he saying? He's saying something, although I don't think he knows it yet. He's saying something about what his hopes are, and he's saying something about himself. What he's saying about his hopes were this. I once imagined that this could work. But then as I lived it out over these many years, what I discovered was it didn't. The little bit of math. What I imagined could happen minus the reality of what I experienced is the sum of loneliness. But it took him 1,000 tries to finally get this. Now, verse 27, he continues on with his diary. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, meaning Solomon, adding one thing to another to find the son, what my mind has sought repeatedly. I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found. I think he's talking about his father David. Here's a guy that, at least in my experience, was drama-free. I think is what he's saying in our today's lingo. Then he says, but a woman among all these I have not found. In other words, the difference between what he imagined a woman could do for him, even 1,000 of them, minus the reality of trying to live that out, led him to a place of loneliness. And he finally learned a lesson. Here's how he finishes this little soliloquy. Behold, this alone I found. That God made man upright. In other words, originally, go back to the Garden of Eden. I'm made in the image of God. I'm made for relationship. And I'm made for God to be a first thing, priority, love, pleasure in my life. And only God can meet my deepest needs. That's what he's saying here at the beginning. This alone I found, God made man upright. But they, including himself, have sought out many devices. Surely I can get one of these things to work somehow like it's supposed to. This is our human dilemma. And the more I'm over here rearranging glasses, over time, the emptier I'll be. I may get a little bit of water in one of these for a short time, but it's always going to end up the same. It's not going to be nearly enough from what I was designed for. Now, even in the best of marriages, with the best of children, with the best of pastors, with the best of life group leaders, with the best of friends, you and I are still going to experience loneliness. What I am not saying is that if we just had the right cure, the right things here, the right needs and desires, I can get this and not experience loneliness. That's not true in this life. even in the best of marriages, you come home and you want to share a joy with your spouse, and they just don't quite, they're as joyful about it as you are. The difference in what the joy you have and what they share with you, the difference is what we call loneliness. You have a sorrow, a burden that you come home with and you want to share with your spouse or you want to share with a friend. And they, and here's this big sorrow that, and you want somebody to understand. And the person does the best they can, but they just don't quite, they understate it. Or they say something stupid like, you'll get through it. The difference between what you imagine could happen and what happens is what we call loneliness. Now, the silver lining is this. When those moments happen, they're always meant to drive us back across the stage to here. That's the silver lining. And don't be surprised, especially in difficult relationships, if you're doing this every day, multiple times during the day. We grow lonelier by trusting others to fill us. Galatians 1:10, Paul asked this question, rhetorical question, to the people where he started a church in Galatia, that the region there. Am I now trying to win the approval of men? In other words, is the approval of men something that is a second thing desire, but I am trying to make it a first thing need? Now, I relate to this because all of my adult life, God has been working on your pastor in this area. Am I trying to win the approval of men or of God? Where does approval lie? First thing, second thing, God or people? If I were still trying to please men, I should not be a servant of Christ. Now, there are two ways of pleasing people. I'm a smart guy if I try to please my wife. That's not the kind of pleasing he's talking about here. Pleasing means I'm going to do something in such a way that when it's all said and done, I feel really good about me. That's the kind of pleasing he says is a bad idea to make a first thing pleasure. Another verse. Proverbs 29, the fear of man lays a snare, but he who trusts in the Lord is safe. Fear of man meaning what? I wonder what he's going to think about me. I wonder if I'm going to be invited. I wonder if I'm going to be included. I sure hope they don't reject me. These are all examples of the fear of man. What are they going to think about me? My needs are up for grabs, and I've put them in the hands of people. That's not a good idea. Instead, he says, but I am trusting, he who trusts in the Lord is safe. Now, he's not talking about trusting in the Lord for, am I going to get robbed tonight? He's talking about, can I trust God with my deepest needs? To be loved, to be important, to be valued, to be treasured. That somebody wants me with a love that's freely given, can't be lost, grace kind of love. Can I trust him with that? Here, the writer says, the one who does that is kept safe, emotionally, spiritually safe. John 2, Jesus gives a good example of this. When he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. Wow, it's the beginning of the ministry. And so people are thinking, wow, this Jesus, he's really something else. We're getting on that wagon. Now you would think he'd go, all right, everybody come over here. Let me clipboard, sign up right here. This is going to be great. But notice what he does. But Jesus did not trust himself to them. Now he's talking about something in his heart. These people wanted to follow him, but he is loath to make even avid followers the producers of his value. That is a bad idea, to put that in the hands of people. He did not trust himself to them because he knew all men and needed no one to bear witness of man. He himself knew what was in man. In other words, he knew clearly that God was on this side of the table. God is a first thing, need, pleasure, priority, and lemonade is over here. I'm not going to find hardly any lemonade on that side of the stage. Now, the last thing I want to say about, I'm going to do this very quickly, is again, there's some element of loneliness that is inescapable. And it sort of relates to being homesick. I went off to camp as a kid. Excited about camp! My folks put my sister and brother on the train, off into the train, out of Denver, up into the mountains. Got to see everything going by on the train. Ah, it's fun. Got to the camp. They put us in canoes out there rowing on that lake. It's fun being at camp. Went out to the archery range. Had the rifle range. Daniel Boone over there shooting at trees, pine cones. Had fun. It was great. Had camp food. Went to the camp snack shop. Had camp malt. It was a great day. No other place I'd ever been in camp. This time, lights out on top bunk, laying there. And suddenly my heart just sort of goes. I'm thinking, where's mom and dad? Where's my brother? Where's my sister? Where's my room? Where are my toys? Where are my friends? I was suddenly homesick. I'd had one of the most splendid days of my life. At the end of the day, I was homesick. Now, what the writer of Hebrews says to us as Christians, that do not be surprised when you and I experience the same type of homesickness, because no matter how good camp is, no matter how good our Christian experience is, we're not home yet. I love this passage in Hebrews 11. These all died in faith. Now he's talking about some folks that were walking by faith. But for these folks, what God had promised them that they hoped would come in this life didn't. It was going to come in the next life. These all died in faith, not having received what was promised, but having seen it and having greeted it from afar. And having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. This is not my home. People who speak thus make it clear they are seeking a homeland. They're looking for the time when they're going to be on the train. They're going back home. Camp was good, but I don't want to get on the train. If they'd been thinking of the land from which they'd gone out, they'd have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. Home. When I will get to see God face to face. And first thing need, and first thing priority, and first thing pleasure, and first thing desire isn't going to be such a battle to attain, but it will finally be an experience every day. Love this little poem. Sort of summarizes what we're trying to talk about today. A minister passing through his church in the middle of the day decided to pause by the altar to see who had come to pray. Just then the back door opened. A man came down the aisle. The minister frowned as he saw. This man hadn't shaved in a while. His shirt was kind of shabby. His coat was worn and frayed. The man knelt. He bowed his head, then rose and walked away. In the days that followed, each noontime, came this chap. Each time he knelt for just a moment, a lunch pail in his lap. Well, the minister's suspicions grew. With robbery, a main fear, he decided to stop the man and ask him, "What are you doing here?" The old man said he worked down the road. Lunch was half an hour. Lunchtime was his prayer time for finding strength and power. "I stay only moments, see, because the factory is so far away. As I kneel here talking to the Lord, this is what I kind of say. I just came to tell you, O Lord, how happy I've been since we found each other's friendship and you took away my sin. I don't know much of how to pray, but I think about you every day. So, Jesus, this is Jim, checking in today." The minister, feeling foolish, told Jim that it was fine. He told the man he was welcome to come and pray at any time. "Time to go," Jim smiled, said thanks. He hurried to the door. The minister knelt at the altar. He'd rarely done that before. His cold heart melted, warmed with love, and met with Jesus there. as the tears flowed in his heart, he repeated old Jim's prayer. I just came to tell you, Lord, how happy I've been since we found each other's friendship and you took away my sin. I don't know much of how to pray, but I think about you every day. So, Jesus, this is me checking in today. Past noon one day, the minister noticed that old Jim hadn't come. As more days passed without Jim, he began to worry some. At the factory, he asked about him, learning he was ill. The hospital staff was worried. He'd given them a thrill. The week that Jim was with them brought changes in the ward. His smiles, a joy contagious, changed people were his reward. The head nurse couldn't understand why Jim was so glad. No flowers, no calls, no cards came, no visitor he had. The minister stayed by his bed. He voiced to Jim the nurse's concern. No friends came to show they cared. He had nowhere to turn. Looking surprised, old Jim perked up and with a winsome smile said, "The nurse is wrong. She couldn't know that in here all the while, every day at noon, he's here. A dear friend of mine, you see, he sits right down, takes my hand, leans over, and says to me, 'I just came to tell you, Jim, how happy I have been since we found this friendship and I took away your sin. Always love to hear you pray. I think about you every day.' And so, Jim, this is Jesus checking in today." This is a man who knows this side of the table. Let's pray together. Father, we just ask you to make these things clear to us. Help us to see, recognize these things in our heart. Help us to see spiritual truth. Help us to see the wonder of your love that you have for us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.